Welcome to Bristol Radio, your home for Bristol Motor Speedway and Dragway podcasts, soundbites, and more. For more Bristol content, visit bristolmotorspeedway.com.
Hi, this is David McGee, part of the PA team here at Bristol Motor Speedway, and I wanted to share with you some words that I wrote in a book back in 2011 entitled Tales of Bristol Motor Speedway, and we go all the way back to the beginning of the birth of Bristol Motor Speedway and how the whole thing came about. So let's go now to Chapter 1, which I entitled Before the Roar. Waiting anxiously outside the Daytona Beach, Florida office of Bill France Sr., the founder and president of the National Association for Stock Car Automobile Racing, Larry Carrier and Carl Moore didn't know they were about to embark on the greatest adventure of their lives. They'd come to America's birthplace of speed in the fall of 1960 to propose a crazy scheme with seemingly no chance of success. They wanted to build a racetrack in the hills of East Tennessee. Not just any track, but a world-class facility worthy of attracting France's burgeoning Grand National Circuit. Carrier was 37, a successful home builder, bowling alley proprietor, and former Golden Gloves boxer who grew up in Bristol, Tennessee. He enjoyed sports and the challenge of making money. 7 years his junior, Moore was involved in banks and a savings and loan company and sat on the board of a pharmaceutical firm. He'd also had some business dealings with Carrier, but nothing on this scale. They probably never stopped to think that France might quash their dream. This unlikely journey actually began a few weeks earlier, on October the 15th, 1960, when Carrier went to watch a race at the brand new Charlotte Motor Speedway in North Carolina. While Carrier didn't consider himself a race fan, confining his speedy driving to the highways, he'd heard about NASCAR, and he wanted to see what all the fuss was about. That same morning, Moore headed in the opposite direction to Knoxville, Tennessee, to watch his beloved University of Alabama play football against their arch rivals, the University of Tennessee. While the game's outcome wasn't to his liking, Moore's mood improved later that night when Carrier telephoned his hotel room. "You've got to come over to Charlotte to see this," an excited Carrier nearly yelled into the phone. "There's thousands of people here. They're paying $10 to $15 a head to watch people race stock cars. I think this might be a good venture." Moore wasn't initially excited, having already seen one NASCAR race. When he ran the Pirates Den Bar in Florida in the 1950s, Moore had actually sponsored a car in the old Daytona Beach and Road Course. The car didn't win, but when it broke down in the middle of the track, officials let it sit there all day, and fans couldn't miss seeing the name of Moore's little waterfront bar. But Carrier persisted, and Moore finally relented. "I flew over to Charlotte the next day, and we sat in the stands and saw that race," Moore said. "It was a long race with plenty of crashes, and more than once I asked Larry if we could go. But Carrier kept telling him no." Why no? Because the wheels inside Carrier's head were turning faster than those on the National 400 winner Speedy Thompson's Ford. What, Carrier thought, if they built something like this in Northeast Tennessee? Once back home, the two men met for dinner at Benny's Drive-In Restaurant, a cozy little hamburger and hot dog place popular with the local high school set. They talked about the crowds, the excitement, the danger, and what looked like a chance to make a lot of money. Convinced it was a great opportunity, the audacious duo decided to travel to Florida and pitch their plan to NASCAR's founder. "We got in to see Bill France," Moore recalled. "We talked, and he sent us to talk to Pat Purcell, who is their executive manager. He was a carny, an old carnival promoter. In fact, Purcell was France's right hand. A native North Dakotan, Purcell joined up with France's fledgling organization in 1952 and helped organize moonshine runners, outlaws, and other daredevils into a respectable racing series for stock cars. Purcell took a liking to Carrier and Moore, so he and the naive yet ambitious duo went out on the town. I didn't smoke," Moore said, "but we went to dinner and smoked an old green cigar and had drinks. And Pat said he believed that we could build a track. Problem was, they had almost no money, knew nearly nothing about racing, and even less about building or running a racetrack. Carrier and Moore didn't even own land on which to build their dream. Besides guts, the two had one other thing on their side. Their timing was perfect. Stock car racing in 1960 was starting to boom. Charlotte had its new track, while another paved mile-and-a-half track opened that same year in Atlanta. Combined with Bill France's massive new 2.5-mile paved super speedway in Daytona Beach, Florida, the sport was outgrowing the dusty, rutted dirt tracks common in the 1950s. When Carrier and Moore returned to NASCAR headquarters the next morning, they again met with Purcell, who had just spoken with France, and he simply asked them what dates they wanted. Just like that, a top NASCAR administrator offered two dates on the Grand National schedule, dates that would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars today. They looked at the calendar and selected July 30th and October 31st, 1961. When they were done, Purcell shook hands with two guys who came to town with nothing more than a dream and left as race promoters. Once the excitement of securing their race dates subsided, the reality was that Carrier and Moore now had less than 9 months to find and buy land, design, build, and promote a racetrack. They first enlisted Larry's father, Robert Hugh Carrier, who was a commercial real estate agent. His search turned up rolling Tennessee farmland in Piney Flats, midway between Bristol and nearby Johnson City. While the land seemed ideal for the track they envisioned, something about a mile or so in length, there was a problem. A couple of local preachers learned about the racetrack plan, and they were trying to stop it. "So we had a meeting," Moore said, "to listen to what the community had to say. Most everybody there was for us, but there were two preachers who didn't like it. They thought that racing would bring in all kinds of undesirable elements, drinking and gambling, so we decided if Piney Flats didn't want us, we'd just go someplace else." Undaunted, Carrier met with municipal leaders of Johnson City, a growing college town, about possibly building his racetrack on land near the Johnson City Airport. That meeting was set up at the urging of local race driver Paul Lewis. "I didn't think that they took us seriously," Lewis lamented of city leaders. "Racing at the time had a bad reputation, and they really weren't interested. They kind of looked down their noses at us, but that site would have been perfect." Well, Carrier and Moore soon turned their attention to a 100-acre dairy farm located just off U.S. 11 East, only 4 miles south of Bristol, Tennessee. It had good highway access and visibility. Parts of it were flat, which is no simple feat in the hilly region, and owner Winnie Carter wanted to sell. But just how would they pay for it? "We figured it would take $600,000 to buy the land and build the track," Moore said, "but nobody would talk to us. We went to every bank around, and we couldn't even get a seat to sit down." Growing desperate, Carrier again approached Bill France, who suggested they contact the Burlow Vending Company, a Philadelphia-based concessionaire of Major League Baseball parks, professional football stadiums, and drive-in movie theaters. Carrier and Moore flew to New Jersey. They presented their plans at dinner, again over cigars and drinks, and got the answer they were searching for. Well, sort of. "They agreed to loan us the money," Moore said, "at something like double the interest rate, and we had to give them the concession rights for 15 years. Moore held his hands up as if someone was pointing a gun in his direction. Nearly out of options, and with that July race date drawing ever closer, they agreed to the terms. With money in the bank and the farm's purchase complete, they began to design the track. Carrier and Moore always envisioned a track somewhere between 3/4 to a mile in length, more intimate than the giant tracks, but larger than the half-mile short tracks that were predominant on NASCAR's schedule at that time. The trouble was their new property was nearly encircled by Beaver Creek, the highway that ran along its northern border, and two steep hills lay in the middle. Returning to Benny's Drive-In Restaurant, Carrier and Moore were joined by newly recruited partner R.G. Pope. Pope owned a successful construction company, and together this trio sketched the track's layout on napkins and realized that they would have to settle for a half-mile oval. "It was all we could build," Moore said. "It's all we had room for, with the creek and the highway. But it worked out pretty good because we could cut the concrete stands into those hills." After visiting other prominent short tracks in Martinsville, Virginia, and Asheville, North Carolina, Carrier insisted that Bristol should stand out. Not only would it have a paved surface, but its corners would be banked so drivers could race faster and make the show more exciting. They gave those primitive sketches to architect Gene Rawls of the Johnson City firm Godwin and Rawls to create the formal design. And those plans were first unveiled publicly during a press dinner in Bristol on January the 17th, 1961. That's 2 days before John F. Kennedy became the president. At the time, Moore predicted the facility would be used for civic, religious, and political events, horse shows, county fairs, and other sporting activities. The work began on January the 27th, 184 days before the first green flag was scheduled to fly. In the ensuing months, workers moved tons of dirt to create 22-degree bank corners and relatively flat straightaways. But the employees of Atlas Concrete then poured 18,000 grandstand seats that were carved into the two facing hillsides. As summer arrived, the final step showcased R.G. Pope's workers applying and rolling tons of asphalt to complete the racing surface. Steel cables were used to secure the machinery so it didn't tip over in the turns. By the time they opened the gates for the first race, NASCAR's newest track would sparkle like a diamond in the Tennessee sunshine, with its gleaming steel guardrails encircling wide black asphalt and an expansive grassy infield. In a message to fans in the souvenir program for the inaugural Volunteer 500, Carrier expressed obvious pride. "You are welcome to inspect this new racing plant, the finest half-mile racing plant in the entire United States, with a modern track, a first-class grandstand, a press box second to none in the business, and other facilities that make the stockholders proud of their investment. The opening of this million-dollar-plus speedway, the first major racing plant for the entire state of Tennessee, and the finest half-mile track in the nation, brings to Bristol something new and different. When the stockholders of Bristol International Speedway Corporation decided on building this ultra-modern speedway, they decided to go first class in every respect. Nothing but the finest for Bristol and the eastern section of Tennessee. Nothing was spared to make this the finest." Now, how the speedway suddenly became a million-dollar-plus facility still remains a mystery. Remember, the owners just borrowed $600,000, but the track's own souvenir program comically contradicts itself because it describes Bristol as a multi-million, $1.25 million, and $1.5 million facility. Well, the radio network broadcast of the first race reported the speedway's value was $1.25 million. Even a newspaper headline when the track was first announced touted Bristol as a million-dollar speedway. But Carl Moore is emphatic that he and Carrier didn't spend that much money. Decades later, as the track approached its golden 50th anniversary, Moore still couldn't explain the discrepancy. "I don't know," he said, "where those numbers came from. We spent $600,000. And then he chuckled and contemplated the suggestion that his late partner might have embellished the total. Smiling, Moore said, "Larry was good at that." Race fans, that's Chapter 1, Tales of Bristol Motor Speedway. Hope you enjoyed that little trip down memory lane. We'll have some more of those here on the Bristol Motor Speedway podcast as we bring you some of the great history, some of the incredible history that has occurred at BMS over the years. Thanks for listening. I'll check you out next time. This is David McGee. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Bristol Radio. If you haven't yet, please subscribe or follow the Bristol Radio Podcast Network for everything new from Thunder Valley. Also, please rate and review the show and share this episode on social media, tag us, and use the hashtag #ItsBristolBaby. See you next time.